The Three Bears, as written by Robert Southey, one-time poet laureate, and a set of musical stones, stones on which music could be played and had been played before Queen Victoria. However, it was always on the verge of closing, running out of money, attracting very few visitors, until relatively recently when a band of volunteers brought it back to life again. Keswick is now blessed with 6 different thriving museums. The Pencil Museum is the only one which is an industrial museum connected to a specific industry, a type of museum you find all over the UK. And the pencil factory itself is still going strong, the only factory in the UK still manufacturing pencils. And only pencils. That's all they do. The death of pencils, like the death of books when radio and TV came in, is often being predicted. But so far they have managed to survive the arrival of biros and felt pens and, more recently, computers. Fortunately, we have always been strong in the arts and crafts field rather than the technical. One of our rivals was more affected by computers and has now closed its UK factory. Architects in the old days used a lot of pencils, high-class expensive ones, but CAD came in, enabling them to do drawings on computers, so that market has dwindled. We never sold a lot to the commercial and scientific world. We have been strongest in coloured pencils used by children, schools, and also artists. Parents still start off their children on coloured pencils from about the age of 3, as they are too young for computers and they are not to be trusted with biros or felt pens because of the mess and marks they leave. So pencils are still a natural thing which we all grow up using. Children and schools still love them and use a lot, which is lucky for us. But we have also been lucky in that in the last few years there has been a boom in arts and crafts, especially amongst older people. Many retired people are taking up drawing and painting, something they did as a child and then forgot. They decide to go back to it and need modern materials, help and guidance. To cater for their needs, the Cumberland Pencil Company now produces 1 million pencils a week in 1,000 different types, covering 10 different ranges and uses, including watercolour. Watercolour pencils? I'd never heard of them, which shows how little I know. They've been going for some years. They look like ordinary coloured pencils, but having done your drawing of a flower or an animal, you then paint over it with a water brush, which contains just tap water, or with a conventional artist's paintbrush, and bingo, the pencil drawing jumps into new life as a watercolour painting. They have a full-time research and development department that is permanently working on new uses and forms of pencils, such as charcoal pencils. The latest is called Inktense, and is an advance on the watercolour pencils in that once the water is applied, the painting becomes permanent, as fixed as an oil painting. We lead the pencil world in innovation. At the world level, we have 2 main rival firms, one in Germany, which is part of a bigger group, and one in Switzerland, but we like to believe that no other pencil company in the world has the range of different pencils we have. Over 60% of our production is exported, and we sell to 80 different countries. Until very recently, the pencil factory was on the same site it had occupied since 1832, right beside the Pencil Museum. But in 2008 it relocated to Workington, some 20 miles away. They had wanted to expand their old factory and the museum, redeveloping the whole site, adding some new buildings and residential houses, but they couldn't get the appropriate planning permissions, so in the end they sold the site and built a brand new factory costing £5 million at Lily Hall, an industrial estate outside Workington. It was formally opened by Her Majesty the Queen on the 5th of June 2008, and today employs 85 people. It was the biggest industrial employer in Keswick till it moved. Fortunately, 75% of the workforce ended up with a shorter journey to work, as most were already living in Cockermouth or on the West Coast, except for David himself. He happens to live in Penrith, so his journey to work has doubled. None of the graphite used in Cumberland pencils today comes from Cumberland, and it hasn't for the last 100 years or more. The Borrowdale graphite mine ran out in about 1890, though the factory had enough supplies in stock to last till 1905. Since then, all their graphite has been imported. Today they get stocks of the quality they need from Sri Lanka. though China and Korea also produce graphite. Even sadder in a way, the Cumberland Pencil Company is not Cumbrian-owned. But then it hasn't been for several decades, having been part of Rexel. Today it is owned by an American company called ACCO Brands, which produces office supplies, located near Chicago. They are clearly very pleased with the success of the factory and of the museum. They have plans to expand the museum if they can get the right permissions, increasing its size and contents by 50%, as they still have large archives in store. So, what is there to see today? I went round with Alex Spencer, the curator, the person responsible for having introduced many of the interactive features. She comes originally from Leicester, and for 10 years was manager of a women's fashion store called Etam in the Metro Centre in Gateshead. I woke up one day when I got to 30 and thought, what am I doing? I don't want to spend the rest of my life in retail. She saw an advert for a job with English Heritage in the northeast, looking after 9 of their properties. Then, 3 years ago, she heard the Pencil Museum job was vacant. Her experience in the retail trade, as well as tourism, obviously helped her get the job, and she has introduced the cafe and greatly expanded the shop, two elements that any half-decent museum, however small and idiosyncratic, needs to survive. A cafe had been thought of before, but it was viewed as a distraction that would require endless regulations to be overcome in a building that is not exactly modern. In fact, from the outside, it looks a bit like a Nissen hut left over from the last war. Alex managed all this, as well as the new features, and the museum now has a staff of 12, double the number it had when she arrived. The main development has been in the interactive activities, laying on demonstrations and courses in drawing and painting. Going round, there seemed to be groups everywhere, children and the elderly, busily engaged in drawing and painting. Children get free materials and prizes for the best efforts each day. Adults were being offered a free hour with a trained botanical artist, who was instructing them how to draw flowers and fruit, using, of course, Derwent watercolour pencils. For a whole day's workshop, on a wide variety of subjects including landscapes, seascapes and animals, and using different materials, such as pastels, inclusive of the materials, the charge is £40. They are trying to offer as many of these as possible in the winter months, as the summer months are the best times for visitors, especially if it rains. Given a really hot, brilliant, sunny Lakeland summer, which of course we are all longing for, their annual attendance can drop from 100,000 down to nearer 80,000. You approach the exhibits via a tunnel, which is a bit naff and corny and is meant to recreate an old graphite mine, complete with miners and picks lying around. It did include suitable noises and at one time water dripping to show how tough the work was, till they had a flood. But all the displays were splendid, so attractive and colourful, especially the old boxes and tins of Derwent pencils, their main trade name, from the 1930s and earlier. There are old machines and explanations of how pencils are made, using the same wood today, Canadian cedar, as in the 19th century when it all began. They have pencils from 1840 onwards. One of the ways of dating them is that in the very early ones, when pencils were still a cottage industry and were made by hand, the lead inside was rectangular in shape, the way it had been cut with a saw. From 1912, when factories took over, the lead was round, having been machine extruded. There are lots of special commemorative boxes, sold over the years to mark important national occasions, and which they still produce. In 2007, to celebrate 175 years of pencil manufacturing in Keswick, they made 175 sets of a box of 350 different pencils, which sold for £500. All the boxes were made of mahogany and contained repro items from the museum as well as the pencils. Only one of them is left in a display cabinet. There are some very keen pencil collectors, as I should have expected, since there is nothing in this world that can't be collected, who will buy old pencil memorabilia. Most of the collectors are in America, where there are pencil clubs and websites. The museum now has its own little video theatre, where a 10-minute film takes you through the manufacturing process. But I suppose the single most fascinating item is still the one I was most interested in 25 years ago on my first visit. This is the Second World War secret pencil that contained a compass and a map, and was given to RAF pilots in case they had to crash land over Germany or were trying to escape from a POW camp. I can stare at it for ages, marvelling at the titchy but real compass that was hidden inside, along with the little map made of what looks like a silk material. Each map had a code, depending on what region of Germany you might happen to be wanting to escape from, with the best routes over the border into Holland or Belgium. They were created by a wartime boffin called Charles Fraser Smith, who was the real-life version of Q from the James Bond films. Officially, he was employed in the clothing department of the Ministry of Supply, but unknown to even his own secretary and boss, he was secretly working for MI6, providing equipment for special ops agents who were going behind enemy lines. He started with counterfeit uniforms for them to wear when dropped into enemy territory, then moved on to other and more ingenious devices, such as a miniature camera hidden in a cigarette lighter, plus a shaving brush with a hollow handle to contain the film. He invented steel shoelaces which could be used as a garrote, very handy for strangling baddies. He secreted torches and knives inside the heels of boots and the rims of hats, all devilishly ingenious. The order to make the special pencils reached the Cumberland Pencil Company in around 1942, but it was so secret that only a handful of the managers knew about it. They returned to the factory after all the workers had gone home and made the special pencils themselves. David Sharrock says that all trace of the order has disappeared from their archives, which are normally very good. He suspects that all written reference to and details of their manufacture had to be returned to the government, so no one now knows how many were in fact made. 20 are known to exist today, 2 of which are in the Pencil Museum. Did they really work? Did the Germans ever find out? Did they have their own fiendish forms of secret devices? It's not often on my museum trail that I've come away still asking myself questions. When I first went to the museum, they also had on display what was then described as the world's biggest pencil, some 7 feet long. It got the museum quite a bit of national publicity when it got into the Guinness Book of Records. It had originally been made in 1978, before the museum opened, to raise money for the Keswick Mountain Rescue Team. It went out on tour, to schools and clubs. Oh, life was simpler in those good old days before B-list celebs took over from giant HB pencils. It has since been superseded by rival attractions elsewhere in the world, such as Kuala Lumpur, where they are keen to make their own mark. Ha ha. Today, the Pencil Museum has its original biggie, standing straight up on its end so visitors can pose beside it and have their photos taken, as naturally I did. But they also have, lying down on its side like a stranded whale, a monster 25-foot-long yellow pencil, which they boast is the longest coloured pencil in the world, so sucks to Kuala Lumpur. It demonstrates that Cumberland Pencils, after all these years, is still a world force. It does, though, take up such a lot of room in a museum overflowing with so many small-scale goodies that it seems a waste of valuable space. But I suppose it does make a point. Okay, that's the last pencil joke. The thing I'd like most would be the little pencil with the map and compass inside. That would amuse my grandchildren and would be a talking point of any collection I decide to display in my own museum. Not that I'm sure yet what I'm going to allow the world to share. Perhaps I should just stick to one theme. The Pencil Museum shows how it can be done. One simple everyday object, yet they have expanded backwards and frontwards and sideways using lateral thinking, good research, and audience participation. The success of the Pencil Museum shows that so-called industrial museums can be fun and fascinating, and that they can become big places with lashings to see and do, despite being devoted to just a single small object. I did worry, though, about including pencils in this book, because of their association with a factory and an industry. Though, of course, the museum fitted my main brief perfectly, being genuinely concerned with just one apparently humdrum object. My other worry was that it hadn't come from the collecting of one single obsessive collector, which is what I had been looking out for ever since I left London. But, aha, there is another museum in Keswick with a collector and collection that certainly did appear to fit all of my self-imposed criteria. The Cumberland Pencil Museum, Southey Works, Keswick, Cumbria, CA 12, 5NG, telephone 01768773626, www.pencilmuseum.co.uk. Chapter 10. Cars of the Stars, Keswick. In 1982, a 30-year-old dentist called Peter Nelson was driving from his home in Applethwaite, just under Skiddaw in the heart of the Lake District, to his surgery in Keswick. Suddenly, in the road ahead of him, he found himself being flagged down by a total stranger. Was it a cop, and had he been speeding? Someone who had broken down and needed help? Could it be a hold-up? Dentists, as we know, are pretty well paid these days, so someone could be after his wallet. It turned out to be a researcher from Granada TV. They were filming scenes nearby on the shores of Derwentwater for a popular TV series of the 80s called Spoils of War, and they needed a car just like his, a 1947 MGTC, to use for 10 days. They offered him £100 a day for the loan of his car, and he said, "Done." After it was all over, and he'd had his car returned and watched it on TV, he found himself thinking, "I wonder what happens to all the other cars that have been used on TV and in films over the last 5 decades or so. Where do they end up? Do they go back to their owners? Or what?" And then he forgot about it and went back to concentrating on dentistry. He was running a successful practice in Keswick, doing very well despite having started with no family money or professional background. He was born in Carlisle in 1951, where his father was a policeman, a fairly humble one, working as a dog handler, though in his family he did have an uncle who had risen to be Chief Constable of Cumbria. During his childhood, his father was constantly being posted around Cumbria to Wigton, Kendal, Penrith, plus a spell in Liverpool. "I think I went to 20 different schools in all, which rather knocks your education." He ended up in Whitehaven, where he did his O and A levels, then wondered what to do next, perhaps be a policeman like his father. "The only thing I'd really enjoyed at school was art, though I was quite good at science subjects. I'd also enjoyed things like collecting stamps, coins, cigarette cards and birds' eggs. A bit galling now to admit it, but that's what boys did in the 50s, not realizing how harmful it was to the birds. My uncle, the chief constable, advised against the police and said the two best, safest professions to get into were to be a solicitor or a dentist. My dad liked the idea of dentistry, and a teacher at school, who was Welsh, encouraged me to apply to the Cardiff Dental Hospital, as it was new and supposed to be very good." So, off he went to Cardiff to do a 5-year degree in dentistry. He did get grants, but not quite enough to live on, so he looked around for a spare-time job. He applied to a music shop, and when they asked if he could repair guitars, he said yes, which was a lie. His father, however, had been a joiner before becoming a policeman, and he sent him down some special glues and clamps. "The first guitar I repaired turned out well, and I found myself spending my time repairing them instead of selling them on the counter. I got well paid and was in great demand, so much so that I was able to buy myself a sports car while still a student. It was a Triumph Spitfire, which I bought from one of my lecturers." He was a good student, so he says, and had finished the course in 4.5 years. "The day after I graduated, I was headhunted, in a sense, as my professor arranged for me to start work immediately in Brighton. He had a dentist friend who had been involved in a terrible car accident, running over a child, and had had a bit of a nervous breakdown and was being forced to take 6 months off. They needed someone to fill in. So I left Cardiff on the Sunday and started work in this busy practice on the Monday. At dental school I was doing 4 people a day. Suddenly I had to do up to 20. But it went well, and after 6 months I was offered another 6 months as a locum with another practice, then a spell in Birmingham and in North Lancs. After only 2 or 3 years of working, I was earning very good money, around £20,000 a year, when I saw this advert in the British Dental Journal for a dental practice for sale in Keswick. I wanted to return to my home county, and this seemed ideal. It was the best practice in Keswick, partly because the dentist had 2 brothers who were local doctors, and they referred patients to him. I bought the practice, and the large Victorian house in the middle of Keswick where it was situated, with a flat on top, though I had to get a massive mortgage. Once again, he did well, earning good money, and was soon running the latest Porsche 911, as well as his old MG. One day, a friend told me that the old Royal Oak Hotel was selling off its garage just behind Main Street, and they'd got planning permission to build 20 flats on the site. I suppose I'd always been a bit of an entrepreneur without quite realizing it, so I got a bank loan and bought it. I had a good cash flow from the dental practice, so that helped. But in the end, I discovered that building 20 flats would cost a lot more than I had anticipated. It would mean massive borrowing and uncertainty, so I just kept the garage empty, as it was, except I put my MG and Porsche in it. Thanks to that incident with the TV people, which had got him thinking about what happened to old cars in films, he decided not to use the empty garage for flats, but instead to track down as many ex-film and TV vehicles as he could, store them in the garage, and then, if he got enough, perhaps turn it into a museum. He saw it as a hobby, an unusual, if rather, mad form of collecting, which would provide relaxation from his real work as a dentist. Having made this decision, he bought all the car magazines he could find, ostensibly for his waiting room for patients to read, but mainly to study the small ads for cars for sale. He made lists of films and TV series where cars had been a major feature. There were a lot in the 70s, such as The Prisoner and The Saint, and of course the Bond films, all of which I had watched and enjoyed. There was an article in one car mag about a Jaguar dealer in Weybridge who had acquired the original Robin Reliant as used by Del Boy Trotter in Only Fools and Horses. This dealer had specialised in providing Jaguars for a company called Action Vehicles, which was used by the BBC and ITV when they needed specific cars for their shows. I didn't know at this stage that such companies existed. Anyway, it had been offered to this Jag dealer after the series had finished. He had bought it and now wanted to sell it. I rang him from my surgery, heard how he had got it, which seemed to be genuine. I asked what his price was, and he said £995. I agreed, without trying to get him down, and put the cheque in the post. He arranged transport up to Keswick, which was extra. I put it in my garage, so I now had 2 cars which had appeared on TV, my own old MG and Trotter's Robin Reliant. They looked a bit lonely in that huge space. 2 weeks later, I got a call from the BBC. They were going to make another Fools and Horses series after all and wanted the car. Could they hire it from me? I said fine, and they asked how much. I said £995 for the series. That figure came into my head because it was what I had paid, and they agreed. When it was all over and I got my car back, they said I could also have another one which didn't run as the engine was bust. They'd only used it for static shots. Oh, and they also gave me half a vehicle, which they had again used for background shots. So, not only did I get my own vehicle back, having got back what I paid for it, but another 1.5 vehicles too. Meanwhile, by this time, Peter had got married to Debbie. She had first come into his life as a schoolgirl, aged 18, when she had been a patient at his Keswick surgery. She had told him she had just sat her A-levels, and if she got 3 A's, she would be going to Cambridge. Later, when he heard she had got the right grades, he rang to congratulate her and invited her out for dinner. I know, as a dentist, you shouldn't have personal relationships with patients, but I just wanted to help her celebrate. That's how it started, anyway. Over the next 3 years, she did go off to Cambridge, got a degree in modern and medieval languages, came home to Cumbria, and they got married, moving into a house in Applethwaite, and soon had a baby on the way. He continued to flourish as a dentist, while throwing himself into his hobby of buying old cars. His next purchase was the Triumph Roadster used by the hero in the TV series Bergerac. I heard about it one Friday while I was in the surgery, and immediately decided I had to have it. I explained to Debbie that with this sort of hobby you only get one chance. The cars tend to be unique and they only come up once in a lifetime, so you have to act at once. I rang the owner, who turned out to be a policeman living in Ipswich. He said he already had one person interested who was coming the next day to see it, from Jersey. I asked if I could get to him before the other person and offered him the right money, would he sell? He said yes, first come, first served. It was Friday lunchtime. In my lunch break from the surgery, I went to the bank and got a banker's draft. I cancelled my last appointment of the afternoon, and at about 4 o'clock drove to Penrith and caught a train to Euston, got the tube to Liverpool Street, then a train to Ipswich, arriving about 11:30 at night. He didn't know me from Adam, except that I was a dentist, though I had also said my father was a policeman. Perhaps that helped. Anyway, he invited me, a total stranger, to stay the night, even though they had no room. His two daughters moved in with his wife in her bed, and he and I slept in the girls' bunk beds. Next morning, he said he hadn't slept a wink, worrying that I would turn out to be an axe murderer who would kill him in the night. Next day, I inspected the car, offered him what he wanted, which was £10,000, gave him the banker's order, and drove it away. I never saw the man from Jersey. The policeman had won it in a competition run by the Daily Mail, and he much preferred the money to keeping the car. He then went on the trail of the white Volvo P1800, as used in the TV series The Saint, starring Roger Moore. Someone told me they had once seen it for sale in a garage. They couldn't remember where, just somewhere in the northeast. And the garage was called either Morden or Marden. They couldn't remember that either. I went to the main post office and got out all the yellow pages for the northeast, and started going through them, looking for garages with that sort of name. I listed 20 likely-sounding ones, and eventually rang one called Morton Mews Garage in Northumberland. A woman on the phone said yes, they used to own the Saint's car, but one of the directors had taken it when he retired. She said his name was James Smith, but didn't know where he now lived. I think it was James Smith, or it could have been John. Anyway, a very common name. Once again, I went through all the northeast phone books and made 30 calls to people in the area called J. Smith. At last, a man said yes, he owned the Saint's car. He said yes, he might sell. So I jumped in my car and drove over. It looked absolutely genuine, but the number plate was wrong. It should have been 77GYL. In tracking down my cars, I'd spent hundreds of hours freeze-framing the cars as they appeared in films and on TV, then examining every detail, so I knew exactly what they should look like. This was very disappointing. I'd spent so much time tracking him down, and now I realised it couldn't be the correct car. But when he gave me the logbook, it did have Roger Moore's name inside. I then discovered there had been a change of number plate at one stage. One owner had had a wife called Jill, and when he sold the car, he kept the number, 77 Jill, because of his wife. So the plate had been changed. I could see now it really was the right car, the one which had been in The Saint, driven by Simon Templar, or Sir Roger Moore as he is now. Listening to Peter's stories of tracking down his cars, I empathised as a collector with his passion, understood his excitement on the hunt, but gee whiz, I have never gone to such effort in extremes when I've been trying to track down my puny little football postcards or Beatles programmes, far less trail across to the other end of the country just on the off chance, based on a few clues. Yep, pretty amazing what collectors in the grips will do. In just under 2 years, he had tracked down and purchased almost 20 cars. He thinks part of his success and the excitement was using the sort of detection methods employed by policemen, which of course he might well have become had not dentistry beckoned. And then came the big one, the mega-famous cinema car that he felt he had to have, not just for his collection, but to have pride of place, attract publicity and the public, the sort of trophy vehicle any car museum would lust after, a real chitty-chitty-bang-bang. There were apparently 5 different versions of Chitty, all of which appeared in the film. One could fly, one go on water, and the other 3 on land. All of them had been expensive, custom-built, one-off cars. But all had long since disappeared, bought by collectors. Peter heard that one was in Australia, having been bought by an aluminium company that had displayed it for publicity purposes at motor shows, as the bonnet was made of aluminium. He rang them up, checked the provenance, and asked if they might sell. They said yes, but the price was £200,000. Gulp. Even for a successful dentist with an entrepreneurial flair, this was a bit too much, but he felt he just had to have it.
We had not been all that long married, and had just moved into this very nice house, but I explained to my wife that this really was a unique chance. I didn't want to miss it even at that price. I worked out that the only way I could buy it was if we sold our house and moved into the flat above my dental surgery. I took her out for a very nice meal with lots of wine and explained my plan. I did manage to talk her into it, and I sold our house and bought the car.
And so, still scarcely 2 years after buying his first car, he opened Cars of the Stars in his converted Keswick garage in 1989. His mother and father helped out on the desk selling tickets, and so did his 2 brothers, while Peter continued as a dentist. He had to keep the cash flowing in. The museum was an immediate success, attracting 50,000 in its first year, a figure that has stayed pretty steady ever since. And his family are still helping out. I toured the museum with him, meeting his elderly mum, wearing a jaunty beret sitting at the reception desk, and his long-haired brother Phil, who had recently returned from Hollywood. Both he and Peter have visited Hollywood once a year since the museum began, making contacts, looking at film sets where cars are being featured, making offers for them if the film looks like being a hit, even before the film has come out. From being an entrepreneur monkey, Peter appears to have turned himself into a little industry, covering all the stages in the process, not just tracking down famous cars, but identifying them before fame has been thrust upon them. The first old car to be seen in the museum, once you have passed the shop and a little cafe, is a 1923 Model T Ford, as used by Laurel and Hardy. It seemed in good nick, considering the scrapes they got into while driving it, being chased by locomotives, skidding into lamp posts, having wheels fall off. Sitting inside it are life-size models of Laurel and Hardy themselves. With all his cars, he tries to create little displays, setting the scene as it might have been in the film. Not being a film buff, or having much interest in cars, I found a lot of the technical stuff rather passed over my head, though I did recognise many of the names, such as the Batmobile, Enid Blyton's Noddy car, the Flintstones car, and Lady Penelope's Fab One pink Rolls-Royce. Fab One took a great deal of time and detective work to track down, as all he had when he first heard about it was the name Heathfield, somewhere in Sussex. He went through all the Heathfields in the phone book till a Heathfield garage told him there had been a motor museum locally, which once did have Fab One, but it had closed 17 years previously. When he did track it down, it was a wreck and needed rebuilding and repainting. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was much bigger than I expected, beautifully painted, luxuriously made and decorated. Harry Potter's Ford Anglia is suitably scruffy and bashed, but that's the point of it. It's an old banger that just happens to be able to do magical things like fly. This was another example of a famous car being used as a prize in a competition, this time run by The Sun in 2002. When he heard about it, Peter immediately approached the winner and bought it from him. There was a fleet of 5 modern-looking turbocharged racing cars, which were meaningless to me from something called The Fast and the Furious. This apparently is a very popular series of car chase films loved by boy racers, which also appears as a video game.
They appeal to the younger visitors who all know the films. They are some of the cars I bought direct from the set when the films were actually being made. I paid $10,000 each for the first ones. When the film came out and turned out to be successful, a similar one went to a collector for $100,000.
As I was going round the museum, I was constantly asking him what he had paid for each car, as I'm always interested in prices. Often, he couldn't quite remember, which in fact happens to me as well. Or at least I try not to remember, often scribbling what I paid in pencil in code, so my wife never knows how stupid I've been, and then I forget the code. Not that I have ever paid huge amounts. Top whack for a footer program has been £500. But keep that secret. With cars from famous films, the prices do seem astronomical, considering they just sit there, being ogled, not being used or driven. Which does suggest there might be a lot of money to be made from running his sort of car museum.
Not really. I don't think anyone would open a museum to make money. I did it because it was my hobby, something I was fascinated by. Having done it, the museum has to pay its way, but that's about all it does. Any profit goes into buying new examples.
He hasn't sold very many, unless they were doubles. That second Trotter Robin Reliant he got, the one for nothing, he later sold for $44,000.
I was approached by an auctioneer, desperate to get some of my famous cars in his sale, so I agreed to that one as it was a spare. I also had a spare Batmobile, and that went for $110,000, but those are the only two I've sold, and I put the money into cars I didn't have to keep the museum refreshed and visitors interested. Museums have an optimal number, regardless of whether you spend money on advertising or not. Obviously, you have to keep adding new items, changing things around, otherwise people would never make a second visit, and you wouldn't keep the numbers up. But basically, you quickly hit on your audience. The numbers then hardly change once you've got there. The things that do make a difference are bad weather. Here in Keswick, our numbers go up about 15% to 20% if it rains. People then don't go on the fells, but look for indoor attractions. But regardless of the weather, most of our visitors come in July and August, the holiday months. I often wonder, if we were in London, would we get more visitors? I don't know. All I know is that location is vital, and being in a tourist area is the most important thing of all. It's chance, really, that brought me to Keswick because of my dental surgery, but I realise how lucky it was, though I suppose we would have done just as well in Windermere or Ambleside, which are similar honeypots for tourists. Edinburgh has a lot of museums, but I've noticed when I've been there that the ones on the outskirts don't do so well. You have to be in the middle, as we are in Keswick.
When he opened, in 1989, his was the first such museum in the world. It is still the only one in Britain and Europe, but a similar one has opened in the USA, in Tennessee.
Naturally, I don't think it's as good as mine. They haven't got the quality of cars.
Competition has put prices up since he began, and many multimillionaires are now bidding at auctions.
I was after one car, and the man said I could have it for $500,000. Which was the price he said Michael Jackson had offered him. He wanted it for his Neverland Ranch.
The most he has ever paid for one car was $250,000 for a James Bond car, which he now has in his other museum. Yes, having said what hard work it is, how museums don't really make much money, he had recently, just a few months before, opened another museum, also in Keswick, at the other end of the town. We walked through the town to the Bond Museum, created like the Cars of the Stars from a disused building, which he converted himself without the use of architects or designers. He even did his own painting and laying of the carpet tiles.
What happened was that over the last 20 years, since we first opened, I've bought more and more items, enough to fill another 2 or 3 museums, so I've had to put stuff in storage all over Cumbria, wherever I could find an empty space big enough. For some years I'd been keeping cars in what was an old climbing wall, one of Keswick's tourist attractions which didn't quite succeed. Last year I got a call saying that the climbing wall was being put up for sale, so I would have to move my cars somewhere else. I realised I had 20 James Bond cars stored there. It seemed such a shame to disperse them all over the county, so I thought, why not keep them together? So I bought the climbing wall in order to convert it into a James Bond museum. I was going to take my time getting it ready. Then I realised that it was going to be the centenary of Cubby Broccoli's birth, the producer behind the Bond films. There was bound to be lots of publicity, so I did things in a mad rush, which was why I had to do so much myself.
The entrance is quite impressive, featuring a tall black tower with what looks like a Bond villain with a gun looking down menacingly. The tower was part of the old climbing wall. Inside, the Bond Museum is very much the same as his Cars of the Stars Museum, with little display areas, but this time there's a lot more music from the James Bond films. It was still smelling of fresh paint and newness, but as with the other museum, it still has an amateur, homemade feel to it, clearly the work of an obsessive collector rather than a professional museum designer. This, after all, is the hallmark of mad museums, and to me part of the attraction, that they are created by an individual enthusiast and not a focus group. Of all the museums I had visited so far, I suppose only the National Football Museum felt truly professional, but then that is a national museum. Peter has cars and vehicles on show from 21 of the 22 Bond films made so far. The missing one is Licence to Kill. All the cars are complete with the gadgets, such as guns and flames, and there is also a real helicopter from The Spy Who Loved Me. One of the exhibits, a buggy that was driven in for your eyes only, was recently acquired for only £1,500, bought on eBay. Since Peter started chasing such vehicles, eBay has made it a bit easier and reduced his travelling. The most expensive is the one that cost £250,000, the Aston Martin Vanquish, driven by Bond in Die Another Day.
That was owned by the Aston Martin company itself, who had built it for the film, complete with guns on the bonnet. It went up for auction at Christie's, which is why I had to pay so much for it.
The Bond Museum also has an area devoted to Bond props, such as guns, golf balls and other gadgets. Although they had only recently opened, Peter was confident visitor numbers would reach around 30 to 40,000 in its first full year, then stabilise at about 50,000 like his other museum.
I have noticed, with people going round the Bond Museum, that they get very emotional. I've actually come across people crying. The thing about Bond is that it spans the generations. The films have been coming out for so long that young and old alike have seen them. They represent important points in people's personal lives, and they spark off memories. Many of the cars I've collected over the years were, in many respects, the stars of their films. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang certainly was. Back in the days of the silent movies, people like Max Sennett and his two reelers introduced car chases, and they were what the public loved. Cars have provided big and small screens with metaphors for heroes and for villains. They've stood for symbols of success as well as representation of escape and freedom. They've contributed to the fantasies of films. Not many collectors get so philosophical about their inanimate objects. But not all collectors are as involved and single-minded as Peter has been. We went back to the flat where he was then living, not far from Cars of the Stars, and he made me some tea. It seemed very untidy for such a meticulous man, a successful dentist come entrepreneur. There were clothes and shoes and paintings scattered all over the floor. I asked about the future. Would his two sons, now aged 18 and 16, take over either or both of his museums? He doubted it, for various reasons. In my fantasy world, I would sell both of them tomorrow if an eccentric billionaire from Dubai came along and made me a suitable offer. I would like to see all the items kept together and displayed properly in a gleaming, purpose-built, modern, glamorous, architect-designed building. As you've seen, I rather had to make do with old buildings built for other purposes and converted them on a shoestring. The objects are a unique part of film history and I still love them dearly, so they deserve a better setting to be taken to a higher level. But deep down, I know they are just objects, and objects are not as important as people. I'm not sentimental about them because they are simply material things. I'm proud of what I've done and feel that the museums are genuine creations, and of course I never felt creative as a dentist. But I'm not honestly a car fanatic or a film buff. It has just been my hobby, an escape from my professional work. In fact, the thing I have loved most about creating these museums has been the tracking down of the objects. I love the detective work, the hunt, the chase, then finding the object, checking it out, doing the deal. That has been the best fun of all, rather than the actual possession. I said I could understand that. With my modest collections, I have felt the same. Getting is often more fun than having. In fact, once I have acquired certain longed-for things, I've just shoved them in a drawer and hardly looked at them again, which is what happened with my stamps. At least, he has done something with his collections. Oh, I have enjoyed displaying them, but it's got harder to get good items as there's more competition and prices are getting crazy. I now know there are some objects I will never get. There is an AMC Hornet, which did spiral jumps in The Man with the Golden Gun. I would dearly love that, but it belongs to the man who did the actual stunts. Once a stuntman owns something, it rarely comes on the market. The collections still give me great pleasure and provide adventure. Every day is different. Someone will ring offering me something, or I get invited to show some of my own items abroad. I was recently in Washington, where they've opened a spy museum. It has things like Enigma machines and documents from the Cold War. They wanted to put my James Bond Aston Martin on display. I've also taken cars to Japan and to Korea for museums or motor shows, and of course they pay me a rent, perhaps $1,000 a day for a month, plus my first-class plane trips. I still have just so much more material not on show. So, would he open another museum? It's strange, in a way, that he didn't start collecting objects associated with his professional life. I, for example, have always collected old newspapers and books. If I'd been him, I think I would have been collecting ancient dental instruments.
Dental objects? But dentistry to me was always just work. I did enjoy it, but 20 years was enough and I wasn't interested in it as a subject. It was just something I happened to be good at. I was always much more interested in art in all its forms, which cars can be.
It was the longing to be involved in something artistic, which he had been deprived of at school, or so he believes, that was at the heart of his desire to create his museums. And this desire to be creative is still there.
4 years ago, I had this strange dream. I'd recently been reading a book about Van Gogh, which perhaps sparked it off. The dream itself was about Picasso. When I woke up, I turned to my wife and said, "I'm going to sell the practice and become an artist." "You what?" she replied. She was astonished. I'd never before talked about wanting to be an artist. I went into work and wrote out an advert for the British Dental Journal and faxed it through. That evening, my wife was at a do at Applethwaite Village Hall. She happened to be talking to a friend who is also a dentist over in Whitehaven. "You'll never believe what Peter says he's going to do. Sell up," she said. Next day, he rang me, made an offer. I sold it to him all in 24 hours from having had the dream. It all happened so quickly, I thought. Shit, what do I do now?
What he did was use the money from the sale of his practice to buy another property not far away in Station Street, which had been a hairdressing salon. He cleared it out, made space for an artist's studio, and rang Winsor & Newton to order every form of painting materials and brushes, from acrylic to silkscreen.
They presumed I must be opening a retail shop, but I said, "No, I'm just doing it for myself, to learn to be an artist."
He took no lessons, went on no courses, apart from a very short one to learn about screen printing, which he then dropped, deciding to concentrate on being a painter and also a sculptor. I was like a child in a sweet shop, running around, trying out everything to see if I liked it.
After a year, he had created enough work, abstracts, landscapes, small pieces of sculpture, to open his own gallery.
One day, a director of the Royal Bank of Scotland happened to walk in. He saw all my objects and said he would like some for a new building they were opening in Birmingham. They were looking for some modern art, but not too modern. They were not expensive items, mostly about £100 each, but it boosted my confidence as a painter and sculptor.
He then went on, with the confidence, nay, arrogance, of a totally untaught beginner, to found his own art movement, which he christened Assemblism. He gave me a leaflet that explained the theory, not that I was all that much wiser.
Assemblism is the form of art produced by the use of skill, method, technique, and imagination, using the 10 principles of assemblism to construct and assemble individual components made by the artist. This is in contrast to collage or assemblage, where the constituent elements are often found or ready-made objects or pieces.
For the last 4 years, though Peter is still running the museums, working as an artist has become his new passion, taking over most of his life, apart from a 6-month gap the previous year when he took time off from his easels to concentrate on his Bond museum. 6 months ago, he said, his marriage collapsed. I suppose it was not too surprising, considering all the upheavals he had gone through. He is now separated from his wife, living in a flat, though he was building a house for himself out in the country, and converting a barn into a proper studio where he can work.
We are still friends. In fact, she comes to help in the gallery, and I still see my 2 boys. I can understand that I have caused all the problems in the marriage by my own turmoil. My wife thought she had married a nice, steady, rural dentist, not someone who becomes totally obsessed by museums, and then throws over his whole life to spend every moment devoted to art. It has caused strains. I've thrown myself into my new love. I tend never to do things by halves. Looking back, though, I never did expect to be a dentist for life. That was never my aim. On the other hand, I never thought I would end up as an artist.
So, is the stage of creating museums over? Possibly, though he intends to keep the 2 in Keswick, unless, of course, some Arab sheikh comes along and makes a silly offer.
I still have more than enough objects in store for another 3 museums. If an ideal location presented itself, I might be interested. I've got 20 or so old motorbikes, some of which appeared in films and TV shows, so one day I'd like them to be exhibited if I had the right space. I've also got 2 waxwork museums, all in storage.
He bought the first from a man in Morecambe who was closing his own museum. Waxwork museums were very popular many years ago, especially at seaside resorts, but have been overtaken by more modern, sophisticated attractions.
I was really after his Laurel and Hardy figures to put them inside my Model T Ford, but he wouldn't sell them. He wanted to sell everything. I'd forgotten about it, really, when he came back and said he'd now sold the property, everything had to be cleared out the next week, so if I still wanted the Laurel and Hardy, I could have them for £1,000 each, on condition that I took everything away as well. So, I arranged transport and did the deal, putting most of the stuff into storage. The same thing happened with the Isle of Man Wax Museum. I bought that as a job lot.
I thought I was pretty daft with my collections, often buying stuff I have no interest in just because I've been offered it or suddenly seen it at a bargain price, such as books on subjects I know nothing about, or collections of coins when I don't collect coins. But they've always been pretty trivial, cheap, small items, easy to store and forget about. Were there by any chance any Beatles figures in either waxworks? I said I'd be interested in taking them off his hands. Too late, he said. There was a set of the 4 Beatles in genuine 60s costumes, but he sold them almost at once. Not slow, our Peter.
I also sold a group of 50 assorted waxworks to a company working on the Saving Private Ryan film. They wanted realistic bodies to blow up. Amongst the ones they bought were D.H. Lawrence, H.G. Wells, Picasso. If you watch carefully, you can identify them if you are quick.
His 2 mobile phones started ringing, each of them with ringtones from Bond films. I got up and wandered round the room. It had appeared a typical bachelor or student pad, with stuff all over the place, but when I examined the walls, I found, to my surprise, 3 Picassos, 2 Chagalls, a David Hockney and 3 Damien Hirsts. "Blimey, are they real?" "Oh, yes," he said. When he was teaching himself about art, he decided to buy as many examples of good art as possible. I was becoming more and more confused. Having said there was no money in museums, it seemed surprising that he had been able to afford so many valuable paintings. He did, of course, sell his thriving dental practice for a good sum, and he has made money now and again by selling doubles and spares from his car collection. And I suppose I was a bit confused by him generally. I'd never thought of someone creating a museum as a form of artistic expression, which is what he had done. Till now, he had realised that art itself is the best form of artistic expression. But at the same time, he is clearly an obsessive, who loves collecting objects, letting them take over his life, in his case to the detriment of his marriage. I saw that as a warning, but of course I told myself it could never happen to me. I could also not be as persistent as he has been in tracking stuff down, going to such efforts, travelling so far. Real collectors, well, real obsessive collectors, are always prepared to go to the ends of the earth, or at least of the Northern Line. I don't think I am up to all that. If I began my own museum, I would keep it in proportion. Surely. Which he says he is going to do in future.
As I get older, I am beginning to realise that less is more. I'm going to be a minimalist from now on. To be a collector, as I have always been, is to carry burdens through life. So I'm going to try and unburden myself in the future.
Can't see it happening. Cars of the Stars, Standish Street, Keswick, Cumbria, CA 12, 5LS. Telephone 01768 773 757. www.carsofthestars.com. The Bond Museum, Southey Hill Trading Estate, Keswick, Cumbria, CA 12, 5NR. Telephone 01768 777 5007. www.thebondmuseum.com. Chapter 11. The Sheep Show, Cockermouth. And then the prize exhibits started to appear on stage, one by one, each of them on their own, unshepherded, emerging from the wings, some in a mad rush, others a bit nervous, some as if taking a gentle stroll, before ascending 2 rows of wooden tiers arranged like the winner's podium at the Olympic Games. Each one managed to take its exact place above its appropriate name, most of them to do with places such as Leicester, Suffolk, Oxford. Then sat there preening, looking around, showing off their best points. They could easily have been contestants in a Miss World competition. "See how they have found their own places," said the master of ceremonies, a Scotsman called Roy in jeans with rather bandy legs, the legs perhaps of a real thoroughbred countryman or an ex-jockey. "It shows you they can read." The audience was very quiet, perhaps even stunned, most of them clearly having been unprepared and now rather confused by what was happening before their very eyes. Can sheep read? How had each of them got to its own position on its own? Beforehand, in the shop, among the 50 or so families milling around, waiting for the doors of the auditorium to open, I could hear kids asking their parents, "What's a sheep show, Mum?" "How should I know?" replied most mums. "I've never been to one before." A lot of the families were foreign, from Germany, Holland, France, but their children were obviously asking the same sort of questions, and getting the same sort of non-answers. I have to admit, I was pretty stunned as well. I don't think I'd ever seen such an exhibition before, anywhere, or had ever imagined that anyone could have dreamed up and organised such a bizarre event. The whole thing is strange and weird, amusing and even hilarious, yet, as the Miss World contest, sheep show, progressed, it was also terribly instructive and informative. But is it a museum? Well, what is a museum? I find it rather hard to define, but anyway, this is my book, so I can define it.